Friday. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a UW study finds that tribal forests in northern Wisconsin are healthier and more diverse than the public lands around them. We'll find out why. First, House Speaker Paul Ryan reinstated Father Patrick Conroy as the chaplain for the House of Representatives yesterday. In April, Conroy issued a letter of resignation from the position he's held for roughly 7 years. In an interview with the New York Times, Conroy said that he was asked to resign by Ryan's office. Now he's withdrawn that resignation. Some members of Congress from both parties have criticized Speaker Ryan over the incident, and there are dueling stories over what led up to all of this. Melanie Zanona is a congressional reporter for The Hill. She's been following this story. Melanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
There are twists and turns, Melanie, and I'll admit I haven't exactly followed all of what's gone on here. Give us the timeline. What happened when?
Well, it has been quite a whirlwind over the last couple of weeks. It started with, I believe, 2 weeks ago is when it was publicly announced that Chaplain Conroy would be retiring. We thought it was a voluntary retirement. A short press release was put out. And then it was around this time last week that my colleagues and I on The Hill started hearing that it wasn't a voluntary retirement. It was actually a forced resignation. We broke part of the story last Thursday. It ignited an absolute firestorm on Capitol Hill. There was outrage from members of both parties. And even though the lawmakers are out of town this week in Washington, the controversy really hasn't died down. And in fact, yesterday, as you mentioned, the chaplain himself decided to withdraw his resignation, sort of putting Paul Ryan into a corner and ultimately leading the speaker to reinstate the chaplain.
What do we know about who had pushed Father Conroy to resign?
Well, there's a couple different sides to this story, right? So Speaker Ryan has largely defended the decision. He has said, look, I heard complaints from Republican members saying they didn't feel like their pastoral needs were being met. They didn't feel like there was enough outreach. You know, I personally spoke to a few members who didn't really want to go on the record or were just speaking on background, just sort of detailing some of their interactions with the chaplain that, you know, they felt like maybe he was sort of more aligned with Democrats. He is Catholic, but he's a Jesuit Catholic, which is a more liberal sect. But then you have Democrats and even some Republicans who were saying they believe that it was a prayer that was perceived as critical of the GOP tax law, which is the real reason why Speaker Ryan's office was upset with him. And it was the chief of staff for Ryan, Jonathan Birx, who delivered the message. You know, this is all coming from the chaplain as well in the New York Times interview, that his chief of staff delivered the message that, hey, knock it off, you're being too political. And they believe that is really what ultimately led to him getting pushed out.
Let's give a listen to some of that speech from back in November that Conroy had cited as one of the reasons he was asked to resign. Here's a listen.
As legislation on taxes continues to be debated this week and next, may all members be mindful that the institutions and structures of our great nation guarantee the opportunities that have allowed some to achieve great success while others continue to struggle. May their efforts these days guarantee that there are not winners and losers under new tax laws, but benefits balanced and shared by all Americans.
So as I understand it, Father Conroy said, and you were just alluding to this, to the New York Times, that Paul Ryan's chief of staff referred back to that specific speech and asking for his resignation. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And that has been the source of contention here. The Speaker's office said this has nothing to do with a prayer, a political reason. This is more of a personnel issue. They just felt like there wasn't enough spiritual guidance being given, and it was time for, you know, time for a change is the way the Speaker's office reportedly described it to people behind closed doors. But then you have the chaplain himself in this fiery letter that he sent to the Speaker yesterday saying he felt that he was pushed out for political reasons, including the tax law, and he accused Chief of Staff Jonathan Birx of saying something to the effect of it's time for a non-Catholic to fill the role, which obviously, the Speaker's office has pushed back vehemently against this. They say there was no anti-Catholic sentiment, that Jonathan Birx remembers the conversation differently. But I think there are still a lot of questions among Democrats. You know, what really led to this decision? What was motivating Speaker Ryan's decision? I mean, it was this huge unforced error and really unusual for someone like Speaker Ryan, who's so disciplined. So I think that even though the chaplain is reinstated, this issue isn't necessarily going to die down that quickly.
Melanie Zanona is a congressional reporter for The Hill. We're talking about the resignation and subsequent unresignation of the chaplain of the House of Representatives. Melanie, it seems like it's unclear, even to a lot of people who are involved, who could fire the House chaplain. It's not clear exactly who his boss is when it comes to a personnel decision.
Right, and that's the other thing here, is that Speaker Ryan did not fire the chaplain, to be clear. He asked for the resignation letter, and the chaplain tendered that resignation letter. Granted, he felt like he was being forced to do that, and that's why he ultimately yesterday decided to withdraw that resignation. But there's a lot of questions around whether the Speaker would have had the power to fire him. I was reading the House rules yesterday, and it very specifically states that the House elects a sergeant-at-arms, a clerk, an administrative officer, and a chaplain. And then it says the Speaker has the power to remove the administrative officer, the sergeant-at-arms, and the clerk, but it does not make any mention of the chaplain. A reading of that would lead you to believe that it was intentional, that it was left out that the chaplain could not be fired by the Speaker. So I think it's really unclear. But at this point, it doesn't even really matter because the Speaker ultimately accepted the resignation, the unresignation, and decided not to pick a public battle with the chaplain. But like I said, the Democrats are going to want some more concrete answers here and possibly even look to maybe put some legislation or some language in the spending bill that would possibly make it more clear about exactly what the role of the Speaker is when it comes just being able to fire as the chaplain.
I wanted to ask what the role of the chaplain is. What exactly is involved in this gig? Saying the prayer from time to time, obviously. What else does the House chaplain do?
That is a really good question, and it's one I've gotten a lot since this story broke. You know, a lot of people were surprised to learn there even was a House chaplain. Their primary duty is delivering a prayer at the beginning of each session, every day that Congress is in session. But they're also supposed to be a sort of spiritual leader of the House. They're supposed to give guidance to members, reach out to members, be someone that these members can go to, can lean on while they're in Washington, D.C. But it is important to note that these are not supposed to be political positions. It's someone that is supposed to be completely nonpartisan. So if there was any sense that members were feeling that he was more aligned with Democrats, that could be problematic. But at the end of the day, most of the members that I talked to said they were on both sides of the aisle, said they were very happy with the chaplain.
And it seems like what often happens is the chaplain will often bring in a guest person from a different faith, a different denomination, to deliver that prayer. Is that how it often works?
That's exactly right. And in fact, there was a Muslim cleric that was brought to deliver the prayer at one point, and that also was cited by sources to me in last week is a reason why they thought some Republicans, especially some of these more conservative, Baptist, Southern Republicans, were sort of upset by that. But look, this has been done in the past, even before Chaplain Conroy. It's not unusual. It's very common, as you mentioned. So this shouldn't have been a shock or a surprise to many members that it was done. I think there is just a lot of speculation right now about what really caused the firing, because it is such a usual, mysterious thing to happen in the House. So that has left a lot of rumors swirling, a lot of speculation. But at the end of the day, only Ryan really knows the true motivation behind his decision.
And Melanie, what are you watching for on this story going forward?
Well, just today we saw the Catholic League call on Jonathan Birks, the chief of staff for Ryan, to resign. Other Catholic groups do not feel that way. They have been very supportive of the chief of staff. Ryan's office has made clear Birks isn't going anywhere. But it'd be interesting to see whether Democrats, when they come back to Washington, if they start to either call for Birks to resign or if they call for other reforms. You can guarantee that Democrats don't want to let this issue die down. They're going to make a stink out of it. They want to create as many bad headlines for the Speaker as they can. So that's definitely something we'll be watching in the days to come.
Melanie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Melanie Zanona is a congressional reporter for The Hill. She joined us to talk about the reinstatement of House Chaplain Father Patrick Conroy and the controversy over Speaker Paul Ryan's office requesting the chaplain's resignation. Northern Wisconsin is known for having rich forest land, but a new study from the UW finds that not all of that forest is the same. Researchers looked into several forests on Native American land and compared them to the areas right next door. They found that tribal forests often had older trees, more plant diversity, and more biomass. The findings could help inform future decisions about managing forest land and wildlife. Dan Waller is a professor of botany and environmental studies at UW-Madison. He took the lead on the study. He's here with us in the studio. Don, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, you don't often, when you have forests, get to go out and do big experiments where we're going to have this condition in this group of forests, this condition in another. This kind of experiment just kind of falls into your lap in some ways, right?
It was a natural experiment, as we call them, of a kind that ecologists treasure. It's very hard. You can't do experiments at landscape scale for many decades, but if you can find lands that have been managed differently and compare what the outcomes are on those lands, you've got an experiment.
So you go out into these Native American, these tribal managed lands, forests in particular, compare and contrast with other forest land. What are you hoping to find out?
In this case, we wanted to see if a history of management by the Native Americans here in the upper Midwest resulted in significantly different ecological outcomes and things we could measure on the ground.
And big picture, the answer to that is yes, it sounds like.
Yes. We looked at five or six different things. The first thing we looked at was just forest cover and composition. That was the same. On and off the reservations, overall species of trees present and so on. But in every other metric we looked at, we found a difference.
Yeah, let's look at some of those things where you found significant differences. One of them, I understand, is biodiversity. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. We were fortunate here in Wisconsin to have good baseline data from the 1950s. John Curtis and his students had surveyed sites in a couple of the Ojibwe reservations. And when we went back to those, we were surprised to find that they had not changed in understory plant diversity at all. If anything, they'd slightly gained. And that's a contrast to the rest of our northern Wisconsin sites, where we'd lost on average about 18% of our plant diversity, and three state parks in northern Wisconsin that had lost, ironically, more than half their plant diversity over the last 50 years.
What were some of the other big differences you found between the tribal forests and the rest?
Well, especially on the Menominee Reservation, you can see this from space. The density and cover of forests has been sustained over more than a century. They have mature forests. They have bigger trees and older trees than adjacent lands.
You saw this. You can see this from satellite images.
Especially along the western boundary. They used to use the sharpness of that boundary along the county line actually to focus satellite lenses. Yeah.
Now, I assume a lot of your research wasn't satellite-based. You're going into the forests
exactly.
To look at these things.
Yeah, we had the opportunity to spend many years. The paper actually results from three or four different studies we did over a period of 20 years. But we decided to look at these differences between the Indian and non-Indian lands in particular.
What are some of the causes of these differences?
You know, we came back to the same hypothesis pretty repeatedly. We see better tree regeneration in the Indian reservations. We see better plant diversity. We see fewer invasive weeds and more tree biomass. Eventually, we came back to white-tailed deer. Browsing by white-tailed deer seems to be curtailing both understory plant diversity and especially the regeneration of trees.
Talking to botany professor Don Waller about, he's with UW-Madison, talking about a study he led comparing tribal forests with other forests around Wisconsin. Saw some pretty big differences, a lot of better things in many ways in the tribal forests. The deer, the browsing by the deer. It seems like a small thing. Watch one deer, it's going around eating, not a big deal. Why can white-tailed deer make so much difference to things like biodiversity, invasive species, the other qualities you were talking about?
White-tailed deer right now in the upper Midwest are acting like a keystone herbivore. They're affecting a lot of different species and a lot of different processes. White-tailed deer densities are at a high as far as we know from ever. They've reached levels in many parts of the northern part of the state that we've never seen before. The levels we found on the Indian reservations were 2 to 3 times lower in general. These are the bigger Ojibwe and the Menominee Reservation. And so we think that's responsible for a lot of these differences. There are also differences, of course, in forest management and in particular in cultural philosophy, how the Indians approach wildlife and how they approach forests compared to typically how we tend to manage outside the reservations.
So are there different deer policies on these tribal lands as compared to, say, state herd management? Or is it a secondary effect of how forests are managed that leads there to be more deer here, fewer deer there?
Excellent question, and we're not completely sure, but we think it's both. We think that is the fact that hunters are often calling for very high deer densities outside the Indian reservations, and we're limited to a 9-day gun season here in Wisconsin, whereas on the Indian reservations, season is longer, the take can be larger, enforcement is by tribal authorities, very different policies and a very different cultural approach to what deer are and what it means to hunt deer.
Are there lessons here that you think could apply, lessons in deer herd management on tribal land that could be useful in other forests around the state?
Absolutely. The big shock for me in terms of these results was to see how poorly many tree species are regenerating outside the Indian reservations, and yet how well they're regenerating inside the reservations. This means the whole composition and structure of our forests looking into the future is changing. Mostly as a result of high deer densities. In the Ojibwe culture, for example, it's considered irreverent not to shoot a deer that presents itself to the hunter. It doesn't matter if it's a small deer or a female deer. Many hunters outside the reservations want that buck with a big rack of antlers. That's a very different philosophy to hunting.
This would be, if these ideas were put into effect off of tribal land, I'm sure you know, this would be controversial. There's a hunting lobby that wants a higher deer density for better hunting during that season. Is this something that would be politically a hard sell?
It's unfortunate, but game and deer management in particular have become very political. This is not what Aldo Leopold, of course, wanted. That's why he helped set up the Conservation Congress and an independent DNR and so forth. I don't think it's all hunters. I'm a hunter myself, by the way. I both bow hunt and gun hunt deer. But I think there are some hunters that are very vociferous, that are very focused on a narrow kind of hunting. They really want a record large buck with a good rack of antlers, something they can mount on the wall. It's kind of a tradition of sport hunting. It's not the kind of subsistence hunting that some other hunters do, including most of the Indians.
One more point. I'd ask you the question, is it direct deer management or is it the way the forest is managed that leads to more deer? Part of your study looked at kind of that peripheral land, clearings around forests as being a great place for deer, and it sounds like there's more of that off of the tribal lands, less of it on. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. The reservations in general have fewer roads, fewer openings, fewer houses, and not as much human disturbance. Deer thrive in edge habitats. They thrive in the younger forests, especially aspen forests, that tend to dominate the industrial private forest lands and many of the county and state and even national forests in Wisconsin.
One person commented on a news write-up about this, hey, maybe this is a sign we need more wolves around Wisconsin to keep the deer herd down. Is that another piece of the ecological puzzle that factors in here?
I think it is. The Ojibwe, for example, consider the wolf a brother. They would never shoot a wolf. And so it was upsetting to those cultures to see wolves being hunted and trapped when that was allowed here in Wisconsin, and many are still pushing for that right now. It's certainly true that wolves change deer behavior as well as possibly bringing down their population densities. So where wolves are tolerated, deer tend to have less impact on forests.
Let's talk about this as an ecological story here. Too many deer has this big impact on biodiversity, on the growth of older trees, on the canopy of forests. One piece of the puzzle has this huge ripple effect on the whole rest of the forest.
It is. As I said, deer acting like a keystone herbivore to fundamentally change the structure and composition of Wisconsin forests right now. We also know that high deer densities are associated with high densities of deer ticks, which transmit Lyme disease and other diseases. We know high deer densities are associated with a lot of collisions on the highways, more agriculture damage and forestry damage. So I think we need to reconsider deer management in Wisconsin. The lesson here from this study and from what's going on in the Indian reservations is that we could learn a lot from the Indians about how to manage forests in balance with their deer populations.
Is it too late? Are we at a point where the off-reservation lands are too far gone? Even if we made changes now, they can't come back to the same state as tribal lands.
I don't think so. I tend to be an optimist, but we also have a situation where there's been severe browsing for a period of decades, so it would take a long time for both the understory and the tree species composition, the regeneration, to get back to something closer to what the Indians already have.
You've gotten some media attention from the study. Have you gotten attention from policymakers, conservation people, others who have a stake here who might want to try to implement changes?
I work closely with the Natural Areas Preservation Council here in Wisconsin, DNR, and Forest Service employees. I think there is a good dialogue that's beginning to take place, partly as a result of this paper, partly as a result of their own work, seeing the impacts the deer are having.
What's the next part of the story that you would want to find out, that you want to come up with a study to figure out what happens next?
The question you asked before was, is it too late? The question I'd like to answer is, how long does it take a degraded forest to bounce back, to regain species that it's lost? It probably depends on context. But here again, we have the Indian reservations here in Wisconsin. I think they could be nuclei for expansion of regenerated, restored forests.
So there could be something like a pilot program, take X amount of land, maybe adjacent to tribal land, try similar management practices, see what happens in 10 years?
Why not? Why not do a few large-scale experiments and really see how far we can get with them?
We'll leave it there. Don, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
A pleasure. Thank you.
That's Don Waller, professor of botany and environmental studies at UW-Madison. He was here to talk about a study he led that found plant life in tribal forests in Wisconsin to be more diverse and sustainable than on the non-tribal forests that surround them. Now it's becoming easier to find a wide variety of mushrooms at the grocery store or farmers markets. Many people enjoy heading to the woods to forage for their own as well. Each type of mushroom has its own unique flavor and texture to bring to the table when cooking. Liz O'Keefe is co-author of The Mushroom Cookbook, a guide to edible, wild, and cultivated mushrooms and delicious seasonal recipes to cook with them. She's also a food stylist, chef, and recipe developer. She joins us now on Food Friday. Liz, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Well, even, Liz, if we never ate a single mushroom, they're pretty fascinating life form, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a crazy, sometimes unknown world with mushrooms. They basically will grow anywhere and everywhere, depending on their type and obviously if the spores are there. But there's just like an intricate underground network of mycelium that links them all to each other, and it's just the fruiting bodies we call mushrooms, and that's what we see. But yeah, it's just scientifically and in a culinary way, it's just endlessly fascinating.
And Liz, what got you into cooking with mushrooms and writing a whole cookbook devoted to them?
Okay, so I think it started early. So I used to go kind of foraging with my mom and my gran and my cousin when I was a lot younger, so maybe about like 9 or 10 years old. And all we used to do was find like puffballs, like giant puffballs, you know, the mushrooms that look like they're just haven't got a stalk and the size of your head. They look like a football, really, and other like field mushrooms. So it was very like minimal foraging, and just used to fry them up for breakfast. And then I, later on in life, I became a chef, and then I went into food journalism. And one of my first jobs was for a like trade fruit and veg magazine, where I met a mushroom wholesaler, Michael, who I wrote the book with, and he just had like an amazing, like what I call like grotto of different mushrooms that he sells to like a lot of London restaurants and chefs and delis, and it was just great, like walking around, and yeah, I used to. Well, I still do take them, but he knows that I do. He gives me a box to pick out from. So that's kind of like how it really got started. Although I've always loved fresh produce, but mushrooms are just so fascinating. We've profiled probably about 40 in the book, but there's supposedly around about 2,300 edible species in the world. So there's a lot to discover.
And yeah, we see button mushrooms in pretty much every grocery store here. You know, morels come around in season, portobellos you see around. We are just scratching the surface there, but it sounds, Liz, like more and more growers and foragers are introducing these different edible mushrooms into restaurants and groceries really around the world, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think these things go in like waves as well. You know, things become popular, they get forgotten about, but you know, more and more we're seeing wild food on menus throughout restaurants, certainly in London, from my own experience. And it's just that extra little special something when it's seasonal as well. So wild and seasonal kind of ticks a lot of boxes for people who are very interested in food and want to try, you know, different flavors, and maybe even, you know, different sensations with the different textures. But also with cultivated mushrooms, in China and in the East, basically, they've been cultivating mushrooms for a lot longer than Western civilization. And the amount of cultivated mushrooms you find in an Asian market is just baffling. And they're all very, very different and intricate. And I think they're coming more into everyday restaurants as well, albeit a little slower than the wild ones.
Liz O'Keefe.
Which is interesting, actually, because the wild ones are more expensive.
Liz O'Keefe is with us, co-author of the Mushroom Cookbook. We're cooking with mushrooms on Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to cook with mushrooms? Do you forage yourself? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Liz, you shared a few recipes with us from your book. I love a good mushroom soup. I do a Polish one, a zupa grzybowa, spelled just like it sounds. Shared a creamy mixed mushroom and tarragon soup. And you say this is a good soup for the summer. Why is that?
Well, it's quite light. It doesn't have an awful lot in it, but there's a lot of flavor. I mean, that's another great thing about mushrooms. You can make a really heavy meal with them, but also they are quite light and textured. And with this one, I've combined more like an Asian type of mushroom, shiitake, with button mushrooms and portobello mushrooms, which basically are cultivated a lot but derived from like field mushrooms or similar to. So it's like it's a good combination of flavors and textures that are slightly quirky, especially with like the pink peppercorns and tarragon, just giving it that kind of zingy, and also lemon, giving it a zingy taste.
We've got that recipe on our website, wpr.org/foodfriday, if you want to try that at home. And Liz, this recipe, as you mentioned, combines three different types of mushrooms, and that you have fun with that in the book. We can get a lot of different flavors and textures by using more than one kind of mushroom at a time. Talk about that a little.
Yeah. Well, there is two different types of, I think they fall into two different types really when you look at cooking mushrooms. You've got the delicate mushrooms that, like trompette or chanterelle, that are very like spindly, and they look beautiful. So they can look great in the dish, but they usually have a different kind of flavor. So they're the two that I've mentioned there are wild, and wild mushrooms particularly pick up on what they're growing on. So, you know, if they grow near or around a particular tree, you might get some mushrooms tasting particularly apricot-y. So basically, with the more delicate ones, they're good kind of like, almost as like, not an afterthought, but as decoration and just kind of partially cooked, so that you get that taste. Whereas with other mushrooms that are more like robust, like porcini, which actually has really good flavor too, or like the king oyster mushroom. They're really kind of meaty in texture, so you can use it in very different ways. Like, it's brilliant just slicing up king oysters and griddling them and almost like setting them as a steak. I know it's not quite a steak, but you can dress them in, you know, a sauce and put them with the same accompaniments you would with a steak, and you'd have a similar kind of experience, I think.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Madison. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. I grew up as one of those kids subjected to canned button mushrooms, and I thought I hated mushrooms. And then I moved next to a wood that has just hundreds of different species and started learning about them. And my daughter had the same opinion of mushrooms, but now we've found mushrooms that have just completely different texture. They're not slimy like that. And so we like chicken of the woods and hen of the woods and shrimp of the woods. The names aren't that creative. And then some, you know, I find some really amazing things that I've actually just spent a whole summer photographing mushrooms. And I got, in this one tiny little woodland, I got at least 100 species in just 2 months. So,
Kathleen, thank you so much for sharing that. And Liz, when you first had foraged mushrooms fresh from the woods, did that really kind of expand your mind about mushrooms like it did for Kathleen?
Well, I did have a different experience. So, I mean, the book is more about knowing where to get mushrooms from rather than going out and foraging them, because foraging can be dangerous, potentially, if you get the wrong mushroom. So you always say, like, if you're not sure, if you're not absolutely sure, then check it out with a experienced forager or a deli or someone in the know. But I've been foraging in Scotland with Michael, who I wrote the book with, and it was just amazing. We mainly it was slightly disappointing that time because we mainly just found golden chanterelle, which is lovely, and it was the season for them. They were tiny little golden mushrooms, as you'd imagine, and they just smell amazing, just picked. Just there, you know, and then we took them home and we cooked them. Fresher the better with mushrooms, absolutely. I would never put them in a tin.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kathleen. We're talking to Liz O'Keefe, co-author of The Mushroom Cookbook. We'd like to hear from you on Food Friday at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite kind of mushroom? Where do you like to get them? Do you have any go-to cooking methods for your mushrooms? Are you going to go to the Morel Festival in Muscadet? It's coming up in, 2 weeks or so now. Are you looking forward to getting out and gathering those morels this year? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for Liz about how to cook with mushrooms, call in 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We pick up the conversation now about cooking with mushrooms on this edition of Food Friday. Liz O'Keefe is here, co-author of The Mushroom Cookbook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite recipe for mushrooms, a favorite kind of mushroom to use in your cooking? Where do you go to get your mushrooms? Are you looking forward to the morels, whether you forage them or do what I do and forage them at the farmer's market? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Liz, let's check out another recipe you shared with us. This one sounds exciting.
Okay.
Mushroom ceviche. We've got some raw sea bass in there. Talk about that and how the mushrooms fit in.
Yeah, okay. Well, with ceviche, the fish, it is raw, but it's kind of cooked by lemon juice. So it's been soaked in, lemon juice is obviously an acid, so it sears the outside. So it kind of, it completely goes with sea bass, it goes completely white. It's really delicate. It's really beautiful. It's a very, traditional South American dish. So basically, I was inspired by a restaurant in London. That focuses on Nikkei food, which is a mix between Peruvian and Japanese cuisine. So it kind of mixes up corn with the fish, and the fish really reminds me of mushrooms. I think a lot of different textures through nature kind of emulate each other, and the oyster mushrooms I've used in this, I've used yellow, golden oyster mushrooms and pink oyster mushrooms, as well as the normal grey oyster mushrooms. And so it looks like visually spectacular, but the it's almost quite confusing because you eat some of the fish and then you eat some of the mushroom, which has been treated in the same way. So it's been like dust in lemon juice and salt. And then there's soy sauce on there as well as like coriander for the Japanese elements. And it's just such a lovely summer dish, and I just felt what a great pairing. I mean, I put mushrooms in everything, so I think it's a great pairing with mushrooms. But yeah, that's where it came from.
Let's talk to another caller now. Deborah is with us in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi.
Hi. I was going to ask a question about a puffball, but since you're a chef, I thought I'd share with you a mushroom experience. When I lived on a sailboat in Florida, and my friend wanted to make this dish for me, and we had to find these fancy mushrooms. We couldn't find them anywhere, but when we did, they were canned, but there was about six different types of really fancy mushrooms in it. And it was ingredients were sour cream, bacon, onions, and then the mushrooms. And you brown the bacon, you drain the fat, you add the onions and the mushrooms, and then lastly you add sour cream. I don't know if that appeals to you, but it was it really tasted amazing. I mean, guess you could tweak it to what you wanted, but it was great. So.
Yeah, Deborah, thank you.
Bacon and cream.
Yeah, I was going to say, Deborah had me at bacon, onion, sour cream, and mushrooms together. That sounds awesome. And that's the great thing. Mushroom recipes, they don't really have to be that complicated. You saute them with some yummy stuff. You got a pretty good dish, right, Liz?
Yeah. Well, I often say... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I often say that if you just... most mushrooms, not all, but most mushrooms, garlic, butter, and a little bit of olive oil with lemon juice grilled, and it's just, you know, the way they should be eaten.
That sounds fantastic. Deborah, thanks so much for that call. We heard Liz from Angela in West Allis. Angela wants to know if people grow their own mushrooms. Is that something that people are doing maybe even more and more now,
yeah.
Liz?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been quite an influx of the kits you can buy. So you buy like a box and the spores will already be within a growing material and you just cut out the front and you soak it in water for a certain amount of time and then put it back in its box and then literally it'll take like under a week for most. I think shiitakes are a bit longer, but for most like cultivated mushrooms, they spring up like mushrooms, obviously, and it's just they will keep on going. Sometimes even like three times. It depends. It depends on like you know where you're growing them. Like literally, if it's just in the kitchen, maybe the atmosphere is not great for mushrooms, you might just get one crop. But I mean I've done it myself, shock horror, like several times I've managed to get quite a few little crops out of it. Some people go even further and try and get inoculated like logs in their garden, but that's going a step towards like proper, you know, professional cultivation.
Talking to Liz O'Keefe. She's co-author of the new cookbook, The Mushroom Cookbook, talking about how to cook with a lot of different kinds of mushrooms. You can find a few of her recipes we have up at wpr.org/foodfriday. Some very great inspirational pictures there, too. And Liz, let's check out the other recipe you shared with us, a chickpea, mushroom, and herb salad. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So this is kind of inspired on the day, really, which is not how I usually write my recipes. So we were on the food sheet, and Michael came in, and he had been out walking his dog that day, called Truffle, and he saw that there was some dried saddle that it grows in a very similar way to chicken as a wood, so it grows in kind of like steps up a tree, but it's almost like got kind of like feathery like print on it. Anyway, it's quite a big mushroom, quite sizable, and it was spring going into summer at the time, and we had quite a few bits and bobs lying around, and I just thought, well, it's just griddle it and put it on a salad. So so we put it with grapefruit, red grapefruit, because it had kind of like a lot of forest mushrooms, that kind of almost earthy taste. So it was nice to add some zing to it. I just made like a yogurt dressing and put chickpeas in it, and dill and edible flowers, some violas, which are really almost, you know, like rocket, really. They're quite bitter, and quite a bit of honey, because obviously we've got some tang in there, and then on top we also used like another like spring mushroom, mousseron mushrooms, and we caramelized that in some more honey and scattered those on top. So it was a real kind of like adventure on the spot with food, which was
Sounds like we lost our guest rather abruptly there. We'll thank Liz O'Keefe, co-author of the book The Mushroom Cookbook, A Guide to Edible, Wild, and Cultivated Mushrooms and Delicious Seasonal Recipes to Cook with Them. She's a food stylist, chef, and recipe developer. We have three of her recipes over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Those recipes are the one she was just talking about there, the chickpea, mushroom, and herb salad, Dryad's Saddle. That's one of the mushrooms that pops up in that one. Never heard of that before this conversation. Also a mushroom ceviche, pretty wild, and a creamy mixed mushroom and tarragon soup. That, I think odds are, that's the one I'm most likely to try out myself. Sub in for my Polish Zupa Grzybowa. We can still hear from you, by the way, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Are you a mushroom forager yourself? Let us know the secret GPS location of your most successful mushroom foraging grounds. Okay, you're probably not going to do that. But let us know if you forage, what kind of mushrooms you like to find in the wild, what kind of mushrooms you like to find at the farmer's market or the store, and some of your favorite ways to cook with mushrooms. Again, let us know at the Ideas Network Facebook page, tweet us at Central Time WPR, and then head over to WPR.org/Food Friday. You can find three of Liz's mushroom recipes while you're there. Then keep on scrolling, because we have lots and lots of Food Friday recipes from past conversations. Staying on the food theme for a moment, think of food from the country Sweden and complete this phrase, Swedish blank. Did you say Swedish fish? Wrong. Yuck. Gross. No, what you should have thought was Swedish meatballs, of course. That's a thing, right? Meatballs are so Swedish they actually sell them at IKEA. But the official Twitter account of the country of Sweden made a shocking confession this week. Meatballs, they're not really Swedish. They are Turkish. Here's the tweet. This is the official Twitter account from Sweden, I guess the English language version. Swedish meatballs, quoting here, Swedish meatballs are actually based on a recipe King Charles XII brought home from Turkey in the early 18th century. Let's stick to the facts. End tweet. Turns out Sweden was at war with Russia at this time, and this happened a lot back in the day. The Swedish king had to flee after losing a battle and took refuge in the Ottoman Empire, right, the predecessor to modern Turkey, and he had meatballs there. He liked them, and he brought them home to Sweden, and the rest is Swedish food history. A lot of people in Turkey thanked Sweden for owning up in this tweet. But as reported by the BBC, one Swede has some thinking to do. He tweeted, "My whole life has been a lie." This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.